Blog Talk Radio.
Five Star Radio presents Mortgage Markets Today, where industry experts discuss capital markets, trading, real estate, lending, and the mortgage servicing industry. For more information on guests of Five Star Radio Mortgage Markets Today and podcasts of previous episodes, visit us at thefivestarradio.com. Five Star Radio is brought to you by iServe Companies. Now your host of Five Star Radio Mortgage Markets Today, Louis Amaya.
Welcome to the podcast. My name is Louis Amaya. Today is September 3rd, 2013. Whole loan trades seem to be on the increase. Some say the first 6 months of 2013 saw larger trading volume than all of 2012. Increased trading volume indicates a normalization of the marketplace as banks feel more comfortable selling off risky assets. What is the outlook for the balance of 2013 and 2014? How will increasing interest rates, a potential real estate bubble, increased compliance and longer default timelines impact trading volume and pricing? Joining us today to discuss the whole loan trading environment is Rob Clare, Senior Vice President of Client Development for Bank of Manhattan Capital. Rob has been in the mortgage and real estate industry since 1987 and brings a broad perspective and experience that includes residential origination, mortgage originations, broker-dealer activity, whole loan capital market transactions. He has worked for large institutions including Hudson Advisor, ABN AMRO, and Norwest Mortgage, as well as the smaller boutique firms of Performance Trust, Hanover Capital, and the Winter Group. His focus on the residential market includes agency, non-agency, performing and non-performing first and second lien product originated or owned by banks, insurance companies, and private equity groups. Rob is a graduate of Marquette University. Rob is up next on Mortgage Market Today.
Five Star Radio Mortgage Markets Today is brought to you by the 2013 Five Star Conference and Expo, the largest and most comprehensive event in mortgage servicing. The Five Star features nationwide participation from experts and companies from across mortgage and default servicing, including those in investment, compliance, loss mitigation, REO, short sales, title, foreclosure, and more. Join thousands of industry professionals this September for 3 days of academics, networking, keynotes, exhibits, updates, and private engagements. For more information on how to register, as well as sponsorships and speaking opportunities, visit fivestarconference.com or call 214-525-6766 today.
Rob, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks, Louis. It's good to be here.
So today we're talking about NPLs and scratch and dent markets. Why don't we start off by giving us kind of an outlook or a comparison of what this year looks like as compared to 2012.
Sure. You know, the biggest thing that we've been seeing is kind of a delineation between three different markets that all fit into that non-performing and scratch and dent market. You know, we obviously still have a lot of the legacy products still on the books of banks and insurance companies and funds, but we're also seeing new non-performing and distressed loans coming through the books. On top of that, the banks still have what they call TDRs, or troubled debt restructurings. The banks try their best to go ahead and restructure some of these loans that are going bad on their books, and they try to make it so that the borrowers can stay in their homes. But at the same time, a lot of those are starting to go bad as well. So we're seeing those three buckets become pretty distinct. So you've got groups that are interested in purchasing the legacy product. You've got groups that have interest in purchasing the new scratch and dent and non-performing. And then you've got other groups that are looking at buying the new TDRs. We're starting to see a lot of the larger institutions and government agencies selling off large bulk pools of those kinds of product, and what ends up happening is that they move from those big banks into the private sector and maybe even the nonprofit sector of things. Another effect that I think we're starting to see this year versus last year is more of a waterfall effect. You've got the large groups buying these big pools, and I call it elephant wrestling. Those guys will go out and buy, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion pools from the big banks or from the government, And then smaller investors will go ahead and buy those loans or REOs from those private equity groups. So it slowly waterfalls from the guys that are willing to catch the knife, so to speak, to the guys that have a very specific role in what they're trying to invest in. And so we're starting to see smaller funds either waiting for these larger pools to filter through what the larger firms are willing to sell, or we're seeing them focus on these other two spaces, which are the new product, non-performing, and the TDRs, or the troubled debt restructure.
You had mentioned nonprofits. In this in today's environment, it's really unique compared to historically in this space, in that you really have nonprofits now as competitors to private investors. How do you see the nonprofits play within this space? Are they building relationships with investors? Are they going at it alone? Are they paying up for product versus a private investor?
I'm seeing a little bit of everything that you just mentioned. The nonprofits, I think, are probably looking at things a little more geographically or maybe even more specific to product type. And I guess what I mean by that is, if you've got a nonprofit that's set up here in Chicago, for instance, they may be interested in just non-performing loans or REO that are here in the Chicago market. So usually when a larger investor goes to sell a carve-out for a nonprofit or even a smaller investor, they're going to expect a little bit of a premium to where other things trade. So in order for them to get the product that they need, they're probably going to have to pay up for it. It's not significant, but it's enough where it makes sense for the seller to go ahead and carve that out and leave maybe what might be a less desirable pool to sell going forward. So we are seeing a few more of those, and I think the government is helping to encourage that kind of activity. So we're going to continue to see nonprofits become a pretty consistent investor into this market.
Do you see the nonprofits or some of the smaller investors that you talk about? So when you talk about the waterfall effect, you have the big aggregators, buying loans and then, flipping or piecemealing out to smaller investors. Do you see the smaller investors or the nonprofits utilizing state programs such as hardest hit funds effectively, or are those deals still hard to incorporate into an overall strategy?
Yeah, Lewis, there's a couple of instances where I've seen some of the nonprofits go ahead and be able to leverage off of the hardest hit funds, especially in the larger metropolitan areas. I think they're using them to the advantage that they can in order to be able to get the product that they need. There's a few groups that are actually working in tandem with the hardest hit funds, trying to just get the borrowers to understand what the program is and be able to get that to be able to stay in the home. We're also seeing the nonprofits looking more towards kind of a social imperative that they have, where they're trying to keep neighborhoods from falling apart even faster, and then obviously keeping people in their homes. It's still, from what I'm seeing, it's still a pretty small percentage of the groups that are out there. Most of them are still private equity guys that are definitely in for a profit. The nonprofits, I think, have a very good niche, and once those are connected with the investors and the borrowers or the folks that are still in the home, there's a good match.
Do you see as values increase, are you seeing the strategy switch with the equity firms or the private investors from a modify to a liquidation? Or are you seeing a higher propensity to try to do loan mods and workouts still?
Yeah, as we're seeing some of the prices of homes start to increase, there's two things that we see happening. One is banks that don't have a lot of this product on their books are probably more willing to work it out themselves and hang on to it. Almost getting back to what you were saying earlier in the intro, about returning to an, a normalization of the market. So we're starting to see bankers feel that, you know, if they can get out at a reasonable level, then they'd go ahead and work these out themselves. As money comes back into, or equity comes back into homes, yeah, you've got the private investors that have these large pools of mortgages on their books, and they're doing all the analysis right now and saying, okay, if these loans were upside down by 40 or 50% going back to 2008, and now maybe they're only upside down by 30, 35%, then how much longer do I have to hold these before I'm back to even? And they put all that into their analysis when they decide to sell. I think they're still in the position where if they purchased 2006, 2007, 2008 vintage type of product, that they're still a seller at this point. We haven't rebounded enough for them to not go ahead and sell at this point.
So, you know, it's been a volatile few months as far as interest rates are concerned, and interest rates movement has an impact across the board, more of an impact one may consider in the whole loan or the default in the REO market. You wouldn't think so as much because everybody's focused on the origination space. But what impact will increasing rates have on the NPL and scratch and debt market?
Sure, sure. You know, the rising rate environment right now that we're seeing, you know, even though it's kind of jumping up and then jumping back down again, I think there's still kind of a positive slope as far as the rates are concerned. And what we're seeing there is, you know, the effect that that's having right now is with the new originations as well as the other product that's already on the book. So in the new origination space, I think what's happening is that the tougher loans are starting to be worked on. So what I mean by that is all the loan originators have been out there doing somewhat what I would call the easy or the low-hanging fruit type of products. Now we're getting into a situation where the refis or the restructurings are a little more difficult. So is the chance of these loans going bad on the originators again are pretty high. So then you're also looking at a slightly higher interest rate environment, and you're just going to run into situations where borrowers are going to default within the first 3 months. And so with that raising rate environment, folks are jumping in hoping to be able to refinance their house or purchase a new house, and then they end up going under on you. I think what happens, too, with the legacy NPLs, with the rising interest rate, I think banks have actually an incentive to go ahead and start looking at getting these off their books, right? You've got a non-performing asset or a non-accrual asset that is not bringing in any money right now, and now we're in a raising rate environment. It probably makes sense to take those loans off the books and go ahead and get them into a current rate environment, whether it's residential, consumer, or commercial. The other thing that is going to happen, I think, as rates go up, and we might even see a rate shift in the short end of things, you know, with the prime rate being low as it's been for the last several years, if prime starts going up, we still see that about 9% of all the mortgages that are on the books right now are second lien mortgages. As prime goes up, those second lien mortgages are going to start going up, as well as the other consumer products. So I think what we'll see is a round of defaults. It may not be as a big of an issue as it was back in 08 and 09, but we're still going to see a round of defaults with loans that have a CLTV that's slightly higher than the property's worth, and people are going to be defaulting as prime goes up a little bit.
You know, that's a really interesting point that that you bring up. Interest rates are increasing. There's a lot of people still in legacy ARM loans that haven't refied for either because, one, they're upside down, or, two, because rates have been so low that that they've decided to maintain their low payment. But as rates move up, you would expect that those ARMs starting to adjust upward. So even on first lien ARM loans, I would imagine we could see another round of defaults as rates start going up for all those who weren't able to refi out.
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, if you've got some of the old 228s and the 327s that were originated in the subprime market, and those are attached to LIBOR right now, and you've got a slight, 5, 6, 7% margin over LIBOR, those are going to start adjusting up, and we may see either a real large round of modifications for the folks that have been able to keep paying, or a real large chunk of loans going into default because of those adjustable rate mortgages, that's for sure.
So this kind of leads into the next question. Are bigger banks out of the woods as far as NPLs and TDRs? Sounds like not quite yet.
Yeah, not yet. You know what I did? I went on the call reports and I kind of checked out what's still left. I mean, even though it's significantly down from where it was a year or two ago, we still, if you take the larger banks that are very active in the mortgage market, the ones that are about $100 billion in total assets or bigger, and it equates to about 15 or 16 banks. Those banks still have about $42 billion of 1-to-4 family troubled debt restructures on their books, and then another $146 billion of 90-plus or non-accrual loans on the books. So that's a pretty significant number, and there's a long way to go before all that product gets run through their system. And like I said, it's significantly down, but it's still a significant number. When you're talking about a pretty significant amount of total assets that still don't bring in any money to the bank, it's going to weigh on these banks probably for the next 2 or 3 years at least. So as banks continue to work out or liquidate these things, they're using third parties, they're still using special servicers, and then they're also obviously using the capital markets in order to move some of these off their books. I think the biggest effect has probably been a combination of all of that. They're going to sell some, they're going to try and work some out, and they're definitely going to use third-party groups in order to do that, because at the end of the day, as these loans run through the books, banks keep a real good eye on headcount. So you really don't expect them to bulk up too much more as far as a number of people on their payroll in order to work these things out. It's a little more efficient to have third-party workout groups, special servicers, and capital markets guys go ahead and do this. So then, you know, on top of that, as far as the banks not being out of the woods, you've got normal production down 25 to 40% in a rising rate environment. So refi volume is way down. Purchase money activity hasn't really kicked in yet. In fact, it ticked down a little bit more this past month. And so you continue to have production offices look to keep volume coming through the door. And so, again, you're going to be going after the tougher-to-do deals, so the loan officers are out there trying to see if, you know, maybe there's some more equity in the house on a refi that they tried to do a year ago, see if that'll squeeze through. Maybe you've got some marginal buyers that have been just hanging on, so they're going to go ahead and try and refi those guys. It's going to be not as clean of a group of loans coming through the pipe over the next maybe a year or so, as the purchase people are waiting for that purchase money transaction to kick in a little bit.
Well, when we talked a little bit about, you know, increasing interest rates, and although it's painful, it appears to be a first step in the path of normalization. And one of the consequences of increasing interest rates is broader underwriting guidelines or opening up of credit, because the banks have to loan money, and they're not going to broaden their underwriting criteria when rates are so low and they can just nail it on the refi. So rates have gone up. I read somewhere last week in the QRM, there's been a proposal for the QRM rules to include now 100% financing loans. So here we go again, right? The whole thing starts all over. We start opening up credit. We increase origination. As a result, scratch and dent and NPLs slowly increase over time. And next thing you know, we're back in 2000. I'm not going to call it 2004 or 5, but say 2001 and 2, where the market was functioning fairly normally. And a lot of people think the NPL trade goes away as the economy improves. But, no, origination increases. And the cycle kind of restarts, and now you have a broad market that is effective, and you have
sure.
a diversified market and capital markets structure that is a continuously trading. Is that what you're anticipating, or if you are, what do you think the timeline is for that?
Yeah, you're exactly right, and I think we're starting to see it already. So if you take a look at some of the new structures that have come out, especially in the jumbo market, I know that jumbo market slowed down a little bit over the past couple of months, but you've got some aggregators and you've got some conduits, so to speak, that we're trying to get back to old school structures where they were doing RMBSs. So each time they did a structure over the last several quarters, you started to see, if you were reading any of the offerings that they put out, the LTVs were actually starting to tick up a little bit, where they were able to get loans with higher LTVs into those structures. And then also you're starting to see the FICO scores tick down a little bit. So even though this is super, super clean product, jumbo 30-year fixed, jumbo 15-year fixed, jumbo 5/1 ARMs to very good qualified borrowers in an environment where there's plenty of equity in these homes, you're starting to see, like you said, with that loosening of the underwriting guidelines. Then you flip back over to the QRM or the some of the examples of what they give of exceptions. And, of course, the big exception is going to be the CRA or the Community Reinvestment Act. So if you've got a borrower that's in a lower moderate income census tract or they've got lower moderate income, then that loan will become an exception to QRM because the banks still need to do that kind of CRA lending. So, again, you know, as you expand your underwriting guidelines, you're going to be taking riskier loans on the books, especially when, rates start going up and everybody's done their refis.
What do you see coming to market throughout the rest of the year? I know it's been quite an increase from 2012. You have now FHA in the mix putting out their large deals. What is your estimate for the last quarter?
Yeah, you know, I think we're going to continue to see larger pools, especially as we get into fourth quarter. The thing, if you take a look at it, the KBW Bank Index is up pretty significantly this year, about 32.5%. So banks are making a lot of money. I mean, there's still a lot of NIM. When you're borrowing at zero and you're lending out at 3, 4, 5%, the banks are making money right now. So it's a good time for them to take the hit. And then be able to sell off some of these larger pools of the distressed loans that are on their books. I got to imagine that they're going to wait for fourth quarter. If they take 10%, let's say they take 10% of what they've got on their books and just pass due or non-accrual, you're talking $14, $15 billion worth of non-performers or non-accrual loans with just the top 15 banks in the country. So, you know, there could be a pretty aggressive end to the year with folks bringing out packages maybe in an October, trying to get a December trade done before the end of the year and make their books look pretty clean. I think, too, we're going to see a lot of the TDRs that didn't make it. So you've got a recidivism rate of anywhere from 30 to 50%. So you modify a loan, you clean that loan up, you try and get the borrowers to pay again, half those folks are going to go bad on you again. So I think once you get that third strike, they're just going to go ahead and put those into pools. And, again, you know, you got $42 billion worth of that product on the books right now. Even if they did 10% of that, you're looking at $4 billion in just new TDRs that might come to the market. So, you know, I'm anticipating a pretty hefty activity of this scratch and dent market here through the end of the year.
And what do you see, what's next for, you know, what do you see past the fourth quarter? If you can give us your estimate on what's next on the NPL and then scratch and dent market, and are, I would make the assumption that 2014 volumes are still going to be pretty good in the residential NPL space. But I guess why don't you give us your outlook on that?
Sure. There's a couple things that I think is going to happen. I mean, you've got a lot of these private equity groups that jumped into the market in order to take advantage of this particular market. And maybe all the juice is squeezed out of it. Maybe it's not, but it's not enough for, you know, what I would call these big elephant hunters to really get excited about. So you'll start to see them become kind of net sellers instead of net buyers and loosen up their portfolios of loans that they've got on their books so that they can return the money back to their investors and create another fund for whatever ends up being next. And whether that's going out to Europe or whether that's staying here in the U.S., you know, that's still kind of to be seen. We're starting to see some shakeup in Europe and in the mortgage market out there. But the things that I see here in the U.S. as far as investments, opportunistic investments, are going to be more of the small balance commercial and some of the real estate, the commercial real estate loans, C&I loans that are on banks' books. So a lot of that stuff was originated in 04 and 05 with 10-year balloons, and the NOIs on those just are not holding up for banks to be able to do a refinance on those. So you're going to either see some sort of an extension, and then again, we're running into what we saw back in 2008. The regulators are going to come in. They're going to say that these loans need to be marked to market, and they're going to be taking hits on these loans that are in technical default. You know, when we see the we talked a little bit about it before, about as rates go up, second liens might be a little more sensitive to a default because you've got folks that have been relying on the same payment every month for the past 4 or 5 years. And once you see that start to tick up a little bit, you know, you'll start to see defaults going. The other one that seems kind of interesting, and if you equate it to what happened with the mortgage industry and you overlay that on with the student loan market, you might see a lot of student loan issues coming up. You've got the government supplementing that. You've got anybody who wants to go to any school, borrow any amount of money, and tuitions continue to go up unrealistically. And so you see the same type of balloon, the bubble happening with the student loan market and the private colleges, maybe even the publicly traded colleges especially, being reliant upon those, that lending structure. So when that music stops, I think a lot of the publicly traded colleges are going to have a real hard time. And then you're going to see people that bought those private label student loan securities running into the same problem that we had with the RMBS market. So, you know, one balloon kind of, or one bubble kind of creates another bubble. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with those three particular markets.
You know, I'm very familiar with the cost of education. I have a daughter that's a senior at University of San Diego and a daughter that's a freshman at Claremont McKenna College. So
yeah.
I feel the pain on the cost of education. But
I'm right there with you, buddy. I got two in college and one going in next year. So, yeah, they're loving me over at Sallie Mae.
But you bring up, I think, a very important topic, and it's not specifically related to mortgage loans, but it's going to definitely impact potentially default rates because you have historic amount of student loans balances for not only students but parents, right? You got the parent, well, you're probably familiar with the Parent Plus loan. You know, parents are taking out loans for their kids who still may be paying on their own student loans. So a couple of questions there. One, I think you already touched on it. It's going to impact the borrower's ability to pay on their mortgage, especially as rates are moving up. So that will be a consideration when you're talking about default rates. But do you see – so you see the nonprofits coming in, and you see what the government has done for mortgage loans and to kind of address the issues which is all caused by, you know, easy money, which obviously we've seen in the student loan space. Do you see the government coming in with a broad program to ease the burden, and do you see nonprofits jumping into this space and seeing it as neighborhood stabilization, you know, trying to get their debt under control and buying student loans and doing deals with them and that sort of thing?
You know, I guess it would have to be. I mean, it's tough to really say what you could do with student loans. I mean, those are ridiculously low. I mean, depending on where your credit is and all that kind of stuff, I think most of those loans are being done in the 2-4% range over a certain period of time. I think the biggest problem that's going to come is obviously those payments get deferred for a period of time. So if the bubble for student loans is 2010, let's say it started there, well, the first round of those guys are going to have to start paying on their loans 2014, 2015. So, you know, we got a couple more years until we see what happens with that particular bubble. And then, you know, that you're talking about 2016, we're walking into another political, you know, election cycle. So, you know, the next president's going to have to be, you know, elected. So it's going to be probably a very political hot button as far as student loans are concerned. You know, what are you going to do with all these kids that can't find jobs, who have $150,000, $200,000 worth of debt? Do they create some sort of structure similar to what they did with the mortgage market? And the political correct thing to do would be to say yes. I mean, that's going to happen. Somebody's going to want to save their political job, and they're going to have to create some sort of program that's going to keep student loans from having to go into default, and people, you know, having that trickle down through the economy and mess up the school system and how they rely on that money as well. So, yeah, we'll probably have to see another, you know, bailout, so to speak, when that student loan bubble hits.
We are just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you one last quick question. Do you see Fannie and Freddie selling NPLs or anytime in the near future?
You know, they're going to have to. I think that they are going to have to get their hands around it and see a good chunk of the loans go out into the private sector. I mean, especially with the rumblings of there may be a merger or one of those goes away. So in order to do that, you're going to have to clean the books. And if you believe that it's going to be returned to the private sector, as they've been discussing, those loans are going to have to come off. So, yeah, I mean, you've got a huge chunk of loans that Fannie and Freddie are pretty much responsible for that are definitely REO and foreclosure. Yeah, I would expect to see a big chunk of loans coming out of either or both of those groups.
Excellent, Rob. I certainly appreciate your time. The information has been very enlightening, great color on the whole loan space. I appreciate you coming on the program, and we'll tap you in a couple of months to come back and give an update.
Great, Lewis. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
That wraps up today's broadcast. Please connect through LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter. If you haven't yet, please plan on attending the first ever Five-Star Investor Symposium being held in Dallas on September 9th, next Monday. I will be broadcasting live throughout the event with featured guest James Lockhart, who is the vice chairman of Wilbur Ross and former director of the FHFA. He's making an appearance on the broadcast, so you don't want to miss that. Today's broadcast has been sponsored by iServe Companies, and we will talk to you next time.